Today is Thursday, August 26th, and you are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinyere for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, Western nations warn of terror threat at Kabul airport.
Over the course of the week, the credibility of the reporting has reached the stage where we believe that there is a very imminent, highly lethal attack.
Plus, U.S. rallies allies against China in the South China Sea.
We're going to speak up when there are actions that Beijing takes that threaten the rules-based international order.
Also, Australia plans first commercial rocket launch. Our top story today is breaking news from Afghanistan. An explosion went off Thursday outside the Kabul airport, where thousands of people have gathered to try to flee the country on Western airlift since the Taliban seized power earlier this month. The Pentagon confirmed the blast with no immediate word on casualties. Western nations had warned of a possible attack on Kabul's airport in the waning days of the massive evacuation efforts. British Armed Forces Minister James Heppey told the BBC earlier Thursday that there was, quote, very, very credible reporting of an imminent attack, unquote, at the airport, possibly within, quote, hours, unquote. Belgian Prime Minister Alexander De Croo said his country had received information from the U.S. and other countries about the threat of suicide attacks on the mass of people, unquote.
I can't share with you the exact detail of what the threat is, but I can say that over the course of the week, the credibility of the reporting has reached the stage where we believe that there is a very imminent, highly lethal attack possible within Kabul. And as a consequence, we've had to change the travel advice to advise people not to come to the airport, indeed to move away from the airport, find a place of safety and await further instructions. You know, we have processed 1,988 people in the last, or we've flown out 1,988 people in the last 24 hours. We've taken as many into the hotel as we physically could at the time when the threat reporting came as urgent as it was. But the reality is that clearly if we are asking people to move away, we are effectively also saying that that reduces our capacity to process people. I'm not able to guarantee. Clearly, we are working hard to find routes to safety for them and indeed for those that remain under the ARAP scheme. But I hope you'll understand that given the threat, the last thing we would do is advertise what advice we might offer to those who have moved away to a place of safety, because in advertising it, we risk making that alternative provision, if we're able to find an alternative provision, a target in itself. So this is a very dynamic, very challenging situation. And I just have to be really honest with people and say that there is every possibility, as we've been saying all the way through, that we won't get everybody out, and the security situation worsening as it has makes that more likely.
That's British Armed Forces Minister James Heppey. The U.S. military will continue its evacuation effort from Kabul airport until the August 31st deadline if needed, but on the last couple of days it will prioritize the removal of U.S. troops and military equipment, the Pentagon said on Wednesday. Army Major General William Taylor with the U.S. military's joint staff told a news briefing more than 10,000 people were currently at Kabul airport waiting to be evacuated from Afghanistan. He said that in the past 24 hours, 90 U.S. military and other international flights had evacuated 19,000 more people, bringing the total evacuation number so far to about 88,000. He said one plane had departed every 39 minutes, in addition to American citizens, both at risk. Afghans and people from such other countries as Canada and Germany have been evacuated over the past 11 days.
So first of all, we will continue to evacuate needed populations all the way to the end if we have to and we need to. If you're an evacuee that we can get out, we're going to continue to get you out.
On the 31st.
Right up until the end. But in those last couple of days, we're going to try to preserve as much capability as we can at the airport, as you might imagine. So in those last couple of days, we will begin to prioritize military capabilities and military resources to move out. That doesn't mean that that if you're an evacuee and you need to get out, that we're not going to try to get you out, but that we will have to reserve some capacity in those last couple of days to prioritize the military footprint leaving, because we want to be able to keep it there as long as possible to do the job that it's intended to do.
And have there been any efforts outside of Kabul to extract Americans and at-risk Afghans?
Yeah, so last night, during the period of darkness, there was an operation to be able to go out and safely evacuate evacuees back into Kabul. They are at HKIA, and they're safely there preparing to be evacuated.
So when you said, was it in Kabul and then they brought them into the airport, or was it?
It was outside of the airfield. Outside of the airfield in a way that, and we were able to bring them back to Kabul safely, and they are preparing for evacuation.
Bring it back to the airport.
Airport, to the airport, yeah.
It was inside Kabul, David.
Americans? Was that a helicopter operation?
It was.
Okay. Can you tell us how many?
We're not going to provide specific details. Less than 20.
Americans? Less than 20.
Less than 20. I'm not going to provide additional details.
That is 90 flights total yesterday that left the Kabul airport. That is accounted for 19,000 evacuees now safely out of Afghanistan within a 24-hour period. Since the U.S. and coalition forces began the evacuation, to date, approximately 88,000 have safely departed from Afghanistan. Every 39 minutes yesterday, a plane departed Kabul airport. These numbers are a testament to the hardworking and brave service members carrying out this mission. In cooperation with the State Department, I can also tell you that there are more than 10,000 people currently at this time at the airport awaiting departure.
That's Army Major General William Taylor with the U.S. military's joint staff. The U.S. government says it is exploring options on how it will be able to continue to provide consular support and facilitate departures of those who wish to leave Afghanistan after the end of this month. Details from VOA's White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman.
At the Defense Department, State Department, and here at the White House, officials are continuing to focus on the accomplishments and rebut criticism that the United States could end up stranding thousands of people who are on Washington's priority list for evacuation from Afghanistan after an August 31st deadline. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki among those, pointing to 82,000 evacuees from Kabul Airport since the middle of this month.
We're on track to have the largest U.S. airlift in history, and I think that speaks for itself.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken says those still in Afghanistan after August 31st and desiring to depart will not be forgotten. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
Anti-Taliban forces were seen patrolling Afghan's Panjshir Valley on Wednesday as Western nations rushed to complete the evacuation of thousands of people from the country ahead of the August 31st deadline for the withdrawal of foreign troops. Tens of thousands of Afghans fearing persecution have thronged Kabul's airport since the Taliban takeover, the lucky ones securing seats on flights. The EU said this week it was planning to quadruple aid and was seeking coordination with the United Nations on delivery as well as safety guarantees on the ground. The UN Human Rights Chief said she had received credible reports of serious violations by the Taliban, including, quote, summary executions, unquote, of civilians and Afghan security forces who had surrendered. The Taliban had said they will investigate reports of atrocities. The Taliban's 1996 to 2001 rule was marked by harsh Sharia law, with many political rights and basic freedoms curtailed and women severely oppressed. Afghanistan was also a hub for anti-Western militants, and Washington, London, and others fear it might become so again. U.S. allies say they have no choice but to follow the U.S. timetable and withdraw their forces from Afghanistan by August 31st, despite fears that not everyone will be evacuated in time. Britain called an emergency summit of G7 leaders Tuesday to discuss the crisis. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Several U.S. allies are evacuating their citizens from Kabul airport, including Afghans who worked alongside them and who are now desperate to flee. Many G7 leaders implored U.S. President Joe Biden to extend the August 31st deadline for the withdrawal of U.S. troops. But in a televised address after the virtual summit, the president made it clear the U.S. is sticking to the timetable.
The sooner we can finish, the better. Each day of operations brings added risk to our troops.
U.S. firepower is vital for the evacuation operations. says analyst Andrew Bell, a professor of international studies at Indiana University, who served with the U.S. military in Afghanistan.
They provide important security capabilities that certainly in small components can be provided by some of the NATO allies, but really the backbone has been formed by the U.S. military. And for the mission to continue, really would rely on the capabilities brought by the American military.
The Taliban also says they will not allow any extension of the August 31st deadline. So U.S. allies say they will have no choice but to follow that timetable. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson.
We will go on right up until the last moment that we can. But you've heard what the President of the United States has had to say. You've heard what the Taliban have said.
Johnson said G7 leaders had agreed a common future approach.
A roadmap for the way in which we're going to engage with the Taliban, as it probably will be a Taliban government in Kabul.
Several G7 nations pledged financial assistance. The European Union has set aside $1.2 billion for Afghanistan. The EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said in a press conference after the summit that aid was conditional.
It is frozen until we have solid guarantees and credible actions on the ground that the conditions are being met.
There are European concerns over the longer-term consequences of the Western withdrawal. European Council President Charles Michel.
Let's not allow the creation of a new market for smugglers and human traffickers. And we are determined to keep the migratory flows under control and the EU's borders protected.
G7 and NATO alliances have been tested by the abruptness of the US withdrawal, says analyst Andrew Bell of Indiana University.
In the short term, certainly this will continue to add some of the friction. There are bridges that continually need to be rebuilt in the post-Trump era. But I think in the long term, this won't do much to significantly damage our relationship with our allies.
For now, the focus of the U.S. and its allies remains on the difficult and dangerous evacuations amid the chaos at Kabul Airport. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris left the Vietnamese capital of Hanoi on Thursday, ending her first official visit to Southeast Asia. In a news conference marking the end of the visit, she said the United States welcomes competition and does not seek conflict with Beijing, but will speak up on issues like maritime disputes in the South China Sea. China, Vietnam, Brunei, Malaysia, and Philippines, and Taiwan lay claim to parts of the disputed waters off the South China Sea, which is crossed by vital shipping lanes and contains gas fields and rich fishing grounds. In visits to Singapore and Vietnam, Harris charged China with bullying its Southeast Asian neighbors, triggering sharp rebukes from Beijing, which accused the U.S. of meddling in regional affairs and disrupting peace. Harris's trip to Singapore and Vietnam is part of a broader U.S. strategy to take on China globally.
When it comes to Beijing, let me be very clear, and the president has been very clear. We welcome stiff competition. We do not seek conflict. But on issues like you raised, the South China Sea, we're going to speak up. We're going to speak up when there are actions that Beijing takes that threaten the rules-based international order. Again, such as activity in the South China Sea. And the issue in particular of freedom of navigation in that regard is a vital issue for this region. Our highest priority right now is evacuating American citizens, evacuating Afghans who worked with us, and Afghans who are at risk, with a priority around women and children. And we have made significant progress in that regard. I believe it's since August 14th, we have evacuated over 80,000 people. And as you know, each day and night, we continue to evacuate thousands of people, understanding that it is risky for them to be there. It is a dangerous and difficult mission, but it must be seen through, and we intend to see it through.
That's U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris. She also laid flowers near the shores of Truk Bak Lake in Hanoi in tribute to U.S. Senator John McCain on the anniversary of his death. Harris paused briefly Wednesday after meeting with Vietnamese officials to pay respect to the former U.S. Navy pilot who became a prisoner of war and was instrumental in bringing the wartime foes together. McCain died on August 25th in 2018. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. A Belgian African company operating in Burkina Faso is planting trees to help curb desertification and open lands for grazing cattle and farming. The project by the company Homme sur Terre, translation Man and Earth, is taking place in Burkina Faso's dangerous conflict zones, where expanding desertification is a cause for strife. Henry Wilkins reports from Ouagadougou.
Eva Douche is Homme sur Terre's program director.
En plus, souvent, les gens parlent de changement de climatique.
She says more people are talking about climate change as something that falls on them and that humans are all responsible for it. There are many things we can do to reduce logging, to control animal grazing, to protect young trees, to improve farming and forestry techniques, to make better use of what we have, she added. The Sahara Desert, which skirts the Sahel to the south, has expanded by 10% over the past 100 years, according to a National Science Foundation study. As land for growing crops and rearing livestock becomes scarcer, it is causing intercommunal violence in countries like Burkina Faso. The violence has contributed to a six-year conflict between the Burkinabe government and groups linked to the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda terrorist organisations. One Homme sur Terre worker, who spoke on condition of anonymity, out of concern for his safety, says life had been very hard in his community before the project began. He says things were difficult because there was no work. Farming was not that beneficial. They also tried to find small jobs in livestock as well. By planting trees, locals can make money from producing oil, nuts and seeds. Trees also make the ground fertile again, which means it can be used for farming or raising livestock. But in an often hostile environment where terrorist attacks happen almost daily, Homme sur Terre's operations are risky. Another Homme sur Terre worker, who also requested anonymity, say community leaders they worked with have lost their lives in violent attacks.
Comment on appelle ça quand vous a tout à l'heure présenté nos conseils stratégiques.
He says initially there were six strategic advisors working for the company, and now there are four, he added, asking if visiting VOA reporters have noticed the difference. Two have been killed since last year. May they rest in peace, he said. Yet those involved with Homme sur Terre believe their work is important.
Faut dire que bon, l'action de Homme sur Terre est tellement noble.
What Homme sur Terre is doing is very noble and should be saluted, he says. The desert is advancing rapidly into the Sahel, and they're taking on the challenge of recovering a lot of land and allowing animals and people to live properly. Unlike many international organisations with a stated mission of improving lives in Burkina Faso's countryside, Homme sur Terre is run for profit. The company says its purpose in restoring degraded land is to foster profitable and sustainable agroforestry in collaboration with local communities. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso.
The former president of Chad, Hissen Habré, died Monday at age 79, 5 years into a life sentence for war crimes and crimes against humanity. His trial in Senegal marked the first time an African country tried a former leader of another African country for crimes committed in office. However, his conviction was less than perfect justice, as Anika Hammerschlag reports in Dakar.
Hissène Habré oversaw the killing and torture of tens of thousands of people during his rule as Chad's president from 1982 to 1990. He was also accused of rape and sexual slavery. At the time, Habré received support from the United States and France to defend against Libya's invasions in northern Chad. He was found guilty of crimes against humanity in 2016 by a Senegalese court and was still serving his life sentence when he died while being treated for COVID-19. Alan Ngari is the Organized Crime Observatory Coordinator for West Africa with the Institute of Security Studies in Dakar.
It was the first time for universal jurisdiction to be successful in Africa. It was the first time that a former head of state was found guilty for personally committing acts of rape. But it came almost 26 years later from when he was deposed from presidency in Chad.
Habré's victims and their supporters worked tirelessly over those years to bring the former dictator to justice. Reed Brody is a member of the International Commission of Jurists and a human rights lawyer who has worked with Habré's victims since 1999.
That a band of torture victims never gave up and were able to turn the tables and bring a dictator to justice in Africa before an African court. These are enormous achievements that I feel proud of, that I know the victims feel proud of.
One of those victims is Clément Abaifuta, the president of the Association of Victims of the Crimes of the Issen Abré regime. Abaifuta endured 4 years of torture at the hands of Abré's regime. During that time, he not only witnessed the deaths of many of his co-detainees from torture, illness, and sexual violence, but he was forced to dig their graves. He says when Issen Abré was convicted, all of Africa celebrated and jumped for joy because Africans proved they were capable of trying dictators on African soil. He says the case of Issen Abré is a lesson for all dictators. You cannot hide. Justice is like the sun. It will always catch you. Abré and the Chadian government were ordered to pay Abaifuta and the other victims tens of millions of dollars, and the African Union was tasked with setting up a trust fund. The victims, however, have yet to see a penny, and the fund was never established. Abaifuta said he will continue to pressure the Senegalese authorities and the African Union to begin the process of reparations. Annika Hammerschlag for VOA News, Dakar, Senegal.
A Taiwanese company, TriSpace, plans to launch Australia's first commercial rocket later this year. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The rocket is called Hapith 1, which means flying squirrel in a Taiwanese indigenous language. So far, no specific date for the rocket's launch has been given. However, officials say an experimental flight is planned this year from a private facility on the Eyre Peninsula in South Australia. Official approval was granted by the Australian government this week. Developers hope the vehicle will reach outer space, at least 100 kilometres above sea level, before falling back to Earth over the sea. The rocket's data, navigation and propulsion systems will be scrutinised. James Brown, the chief executive of the Space Industry Association of Australia, says it will be a significant mission.
This is the first sort of major rocket launch in about 40 years for Australia. So this is a rocket that's about 10 metres high. It's got two stages. It'll be launched from South Australia out over the ocean and it'll get to about 100 kilometres high. It's basically testing this Taiwanese technology, which is a rocket built around a hybrid engine. And if that works well, if it's all safe, it's all reliable, then the plan is for this company to come back and launch a bigger rocket that's about 20 metres high that can carry up to 400 kilograms worth of satellite payloads into space. So it's a really exciting development for the industry.
TriSpace is Taiwan's first private space company, which reportedly chose a site in Australia because of regulatory problems back home. The Taipei Times reported concerns over the legality of proposed launch sites in Taiwan. Researchers have said the project is potentially significant for both Australia's and Taiwan's space industries, which have lagged behind other space programs. Australia only established a domestic space agency in 2018. Alice Gorman, an associate professor at Flinders University and space exploration expert, says Australia is well positioned to benefit from the global space sector.
At the top of the country in the north, we're relatively close to the equator, and that's a huge advantage for launching satellites into geostationary orbit because you get the assistance of the Earth's rotation. In the south, where Southern Launch is developing its launch sites, we're perfectly located to launch things into polar orbit. And this is where a lot of our Earth observation satellites are, a lot of scientific satellites. And we're not looking at, you know, monumentally massive big rockets here. We're looking at small rockets, small satellites, and with both ends of the country able to specialise in different kinds of launch, we really do have a geographic advantage.
Australia's rocket launching heritage goes back decades. For years, launches were taking place regularly at the Woomera Range in South Australia, including missile experiments for the military. The site remains a major Australian defence and research facility. TriSpace has said it plans further suborbital launches and several orbital launches after this year's test flight. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Paul Alexander, I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great day.